Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Asma Khalid. Finally today, let's talk about how secure your phone is. We're joined in studio by Susan Landau. She's a professor of cybersecurity at the Fletcher School at Tufts. She was formerly an engineer at Sun Microsystems and a privacy analyst at Google. But what many people also know her for is testifying in front of the House Judiciary Committee on Encryption, specifically the Apple versus the FBI case. A quick recap here, in case that case doesn't ring a bell. You might remember that following the attack in San Bernardino, in 2015, federal authorities recovered an iPhone used by the shooter. However, it was locked by a four-digit password. When the FBI asked Apple to create software that would enable them to unlock the iPhone, Apple said no. Here's CEO Tim Cook in an interview with ABC News in February of 2016.
This case is not about one phone. This case is about the future. What is at stake here is, can the government compel Apple to write software that we believe would make hundreds of millions of customers vulnerable around the world, including the U.S.?
The dispute went to court, but before the hearings could begin, the FBI announced they'd found another way to unlock the phone. However, the debate continues. Just yesterday, Texas law enforcement served Apple with a search warrant for iCloud data on the phone belonging to the gunman from the Sutherland Springs attack. Susan Landau addresses law enforcement access to our iPhones and other cybersecurity issues in her new book. It's called Listening In, Cybersecurity in an Insecure Age. And Susan, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks very much for having me.
So, Susan, I want to begin with some of the latest news. We mentioned just briefly in the intro here the situation with law enforcement trying to obtain essentially data from the shooter involved in Sutherland Springs. And can you give us a sense of what's really going on? We saw earlier a report from Reuters that the FBI didn't really ask Apple for assistance during that immediate 48-hour window, which if this phone had, you know, Touch ID enabled, you maybe could have potentially used the gunman's fingerprints.
So we don't actually know why the FBI, why law enforcement actually wants data from the phone, because, of course, we know who the shooter was. Mm-hmm. And we also know, of course, a lot of history of the shooter and his violent behavior earlier. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of explanations about the shooter. But in terms of the phone itself, the question I have is, are they asking for data from the phone or are they asking for data from the cloud? If the warrant is really about data from the cloud, uh-huh. then it makes sense to have a warrant. If the warrant is for data from the phone, then I am wondering more than a little, is this really more about coming back to Apple with yet another case, a violent, ugly case?
I see. So, you know, why don't law enforcement officials essentially use the same method that they used in the San Bernardino case, which was to hack the phone?
Because it's a different model, presumably, a different time. Mm. One thing is when the FBI got ability to get into the San Bernardino phone, they got the ability to get into that phone. They didn't actually purchase the vulnerability that would let them get into other phones.
I see.
Of course, Apple in the interim has updated phones and may have taken care of the insecurity there to begin with.
So, Susan, you testified that Apple should not be forced to create essentially a backdoor option. This was a while ago in regards to the previous case we mentioned. And why is that? What concerns do you have about this, quote, backdoor option?
Sure. Thank you for asking that. That's actually a very important issue. So Apple argued the case on two bases, on a legal base and on an issue of security. My concern as a computer security person was that if you're going to use the update mechanism to unlock phones, and at the time, originally Director Comey said he had one phone. During the testimony, he said, well, he had more like a dozen. Cy Vance, the DA from Manhattan, had hundreds, and by now the FBI says they have thousands. I think the latest number was about 7,000.
Oh, wow.
When you have that many phones, what you're doing is a security or an insecurity update to each phone, each of the phones they have, on a daily basis. You're involving lots of people in the process, and you're taking a process that was automated and quite secure by introducing people, a lawyer and an engineer, to make sure that the right phone gets the insecurity update. When you introduce that many people, you're mm-hmm. going to make a process insecure. And that's very dangerous.
So you mentioned briefly there former FBI Director James Comey. He testified in front of the House Judiciary Committee last year about why the FBI needs access to phones. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
The problem we face here is all of our lives are on these devices. which is why it's so important that they be private. But that also means all of criminals and pedophiles and terrorists' lives are on these devices. And if they can't, if they're warrant proof, even a judge can't order access to a device, that is a big problem.
Your response, Susan?
So one of my colleagues, an ex-NSA person, said to me once, you know, the law gives us access mm-hmm. to particular information. The law doesn't say anything about it being easy. The FBI, and in particular Director Comey, kept characterizing the issue as a privacy versus security issue. I don't think it's a privacy versus security issue. I think with the kind of data we have on the phones, with the fact that we often use phones as what we call second factor authenticators, something you carry with you to authenticate yourself to an online account, both of those argue for making phones more secure, not less secure. And in fact, that's why Apple, starting in the late 2000s, began moving in the direction of securing data on the phone with a user's password PIN number.
I want to play just one more clip here. This is John Miller. He's a Deputy Commissioner of Intelligence and Counterterrorism of the NYPD. We heard from him on CBS last year, sort of suggesting that a phone shouldn't be seen differently as other places where we keep private information.
There's no bank, there's no safe company, there's no vault, there is no apartment, there's no door that can't be penetrated with a lawful order from a U.S. court.
So, I mean, Susan, should a phone be different, and should the FBI need to sort of take special steps in order to get access to information on a phone? What would be acceptable to you?
So the real issue is how we secure ourselves against everybody else. When you make it an issue of law enforcement being able to get into the phone versus somebody wanting to keep data private, it's uh-huh. one story. But when you make it an issue of law enforcement being able to access the phone and therefore weakening the security of the phone, enabling criminals, other nation states, other bad actors to get in, it becomes a completely different story. And mm-hmm. that's the story that law enforcement seems unable to understand.
Are we seeing a sort of more automatic encryption at this point by companies? I mean, you mentioned that one of the reasons law enforcement can't necessarily hack the phone in a similar way with the current case in Sutherland Springs is because, phones have updates and we're seeing additional changes there. So have we seen, additional measures specifically taken around encryption?
Absolutely. And there have been two sets of them. The first one was, as I mentioned, Apple started securing the phone beginning in the late 2000s. There was a group of Chinese criminals that had learned how to open phones and take data off the phones, email and other data, which they then used for identity theft and other kinds of fraud. And then they took their product, and they sold it abroad so that other people could take misplaced, lost, or stolen phones and steal data off the phones and then commit fraud. When Apple saw this, what Apple did was created a way first to protect your email with a combination of the PIN, the password that you put in, and data on a key on the phone. And they did that in 2011. Several years later, they started encrypting all the other information. So that's one security step. The other security step is encrypting communications, which is something that has been happening for a while and picked up actually after the DNC hack last summer. And we found that, in fact, people in Congress and people in the political world, Obama's people, Clinton's people, Trump's people, started using end-to-end encryption for their communications. That meant that not only couldn't an eavesdropper hear their communications or learn anything they said when it was intercepted, but it also meant that the communications weren't stored so that somebody who stole them didn't have anything.
You mentioned there the DNC hack, and that's something else that you talked about quite a bit in the book that I wanted to shift gears to. The hack specifically of the DNC during the Clinton campaign, we saw that there were John Podesta's emails essentially that were hacked. This was done through phishing emails. What worries you about that particular case?
What worries me is not so much the theft of the emails, but the way they were used, delivered to WikiLeaks and drip, drip, drip through the campaign, and it undoubtedly had an effect on the campaign. What we've seen over the last year or two is not only in the U.S., but in Germany, now apparently also in the U.K., in France, efforts by Russia to disrupt democracies, to disrupt civil society by creating dissent, by working against candidates. And we had always worried for a long time about what people called a cyber Pearl Harbor, mm-hmm. an attack on critical infrastructure, somebody shutting off the lights in Boston or shutting off the power grid in the West Coast.
Yeah.
Instead, the attack is more subtle, but also an attack that the Russians are quite experienced at, disinformation, political disruption. Disruption to civil society. And it worries me a great deal because, one, we haven't responded adequately to the Russians, but two, we're really not equipped to handle it.
The actual hack itself, Susan, it seems like it was not particularly sophisticated, but it worked, right? And it worked really efficiently for the Russians' purposes.
That's right.
Is this the type of hack that we could likely see a lot more of in the future?
Absolutely. And in fact, at the time when the Office of Director of National Intelligence last January issued an unclassified report saying, yes, there'd been Russian hacking in the campaign. They also said there'd been hacking attempts against think tanks and other organizations likely to influence U.S. public policy. I spoke with some civil society groups in Washington at the time, and some of them had been the subject of attacks.
Do you see that there are steps that we can take at this point, be it either on a sort of a national defense perspective or individually to protect ourselves from this?
There are many steps we can take.
Okay,
the question is whether we're going to have the will to do it and also trade convenience for security. So on the national level, as I said, I don't think the U.S. has adequately responded to the Russian attacks. On an individual level, there are many things we can do. One thing, of course, the simplest thing we can do is always update. As soon as you get an update, go to automatic updates for all your systems. Now, that can
that
be quite disruptive because
yeah.
It may break some things. But that is, in fact, the best security step you can take. And it's one of the reasons that using a security unupdate, the kind of thing that the FBI was asking Apple to do, is particularly disruptive because some people will choose not to do automatic updates.
Right.
The next thing you can do is to be cautious, to be careful. Don't open attachments unless you're sure of the provenance and you're sure that it really is coming from the person you think it's coming from. Don't go to web pages that look questionable. That is, the spelling is wrong. Somebody sends you a link and says, hey, check out this interesting site. But there's also in terms of what else you choose or don't choose to have on your phone, to have on your devices, which apps you use that are more secure, which ones are not.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Susan. That's all sort of like very basic information that I think we can use on an individual level. So appreciate it. That's Susan Landau. She's professor of cybersecurity at the Fletcher School at Tufts. Her new book is titled Listening In, Cybersecurity in an Insecure Age. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Asma Khalid. This is Radio Boston.